This is Main Street on Prairie Public, a place to build community. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Doug Hamilton is on assignment. Coming up today on the show, you think of home movies as something only your family would want to watch, right? Well, not so, says an archivist. We'll visit with Shane Mullender about the impacts home movies have on preserving history. Also today, NDSU students making waves in 3D printing, using the technology in hopes of turning artificial limbs into something that's both more affordable and cool besides. But first, bluegrass musician Becky Buller has made a career of writing, playing, and singing, oftentimes for other musicians, but now she is striking out on her own with a string of concerts, including a couple in North Dakota and Minnesota. Becky joins us now by phone. Becky, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, Ashley, thanks for having me on the show.
You play a handful of instruments, banjo, fiddle, guitar, of course, a strong vocalist besides. Do you have a favorite?
Well, that kind of changes depending on the day. I will say that I picked up the fiddle because I wanted to sing in my parents' bluegrass band. I'm from St. James, Minnesota, and my parents got into bluegrass music when I was about 5 years old. And they had a band from the time I was about 5 till I was 18. And I really wanted to sing with them, but the economics of bluegrass is such that everybody in the band has to play something as well as sing. You don't normally have a lead vocalist. You sometimes see that nowadays, but still not so much in bluegrass music. And usually everybody plays multiple instruments and sings multiple parts and probably can drive the bus and work on the bus and do graphic design for the records. You know, it's one of those things, those genres where you have to be ambidextrous.
Multiple hat wearing. I work at a nonprofit. Yeah. I know how that goes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You mentioned you grew up in Minnesota. What made you want to go to Tennessee to study music?
When I was about 16, there was a record that came out called Carolina Moon. It was by the band Lou Reed, Terry Buckham, and Carolina. And it was a really, it's still one of my favorite albums, but the bass player, Marcus Smith, had gone through the bluegrass country music, bluegrass old time and country music program at East Tennessee State University in Johnson City. And when I read about that in the liner notes, I was like, there's a place I can get credit for playing bluegrass music. I'm going there. My parents were like, no, you're not. You're too shy. You're too much of a homebody. I was like, no, I'm going there. I'm also stubborn. I'm going to go there. And so I did a year of school at Gustavus Adolphus in St. Peter, Minnesota to get ready to go so far away from home. But the plan was always when I did, I actually did that as my senior year of high school and my first year of college at Gustavus. And then when I officially graduated from high school, I headed out for Johnson City, and I've been in Tennessee ever since. It's almost 20 years now. I can't believe it's been that long.
Wow. Have you ever thought about doing your music in Minnesota besides coming for concerts, of course? Or is Tennessee really the place you need to be?
Well, I married a Tennessee boy, so I'm kind of entrenched down here. and we live in Manchester, Tennessee now, which is an hour south of Nashville. And it's a good location for doing this kind of music. It's very, it's a pretty central location. A lot of folks move to town. Of course, it's Music City, USA. So you can't throw a rock without hitting a guitar player, and even your dermatologist and your massage therapist are all songwriters, and really good songwriters too, usually. So it's a good location to be. My husband's family is all right here in Manchester, and they've been in Coffee County, Tennessee since the dawn of time. So it's a good place to be, but I do miss my family up there. My parents are still in St. James, Minnesota, and my brother is in, he's a pastor serving in his first pastorate in both Abercrombie, North Dakota, and Galshute, North Dakota. So I'm very excited to get to see him and his wife. His wife, Erica, is a pastor in Wapaton. So this will be a family visit as well as a performance.
Well, yeah, Wapaton, awfully close to Colfax. You'll be performing on August 30th, 3 to 5 p.m. At the Crooked Lane Farm Folk School. And there's something very intriguing to me about small venues. What do you think is the role of a small venue for a musician versus a big stadium concert?
Well, it's intimate, and you get to know the audience. It's like they're in your living room, except, well, this is going to be like they're in my backyard because it's an outdoor show, and I think it's supposed to be really nice weather, and it's going to be a family event, so you know, please all come out. But yeah, and bluegrass is a very organic kind of music anyway. It's very accessible. You don't have to plug in to play it, you know, for the most part, unless your bass player has an amp or something. You can just take your, you know, it's all acoustic instruments, and the tunes are, for the most part, fairly easy to catch on to, and so it's just fun and accessible, and in a venue like, I mean, a venue like Crooked Lane is just the perfect place to have a concert like this on a nice, sunny North Dakota afternoon.
Well, let's give a little preview of a concert here. We have a part of a song here called How I Love You.
Another midnight come and gone in the dead of a late December as the snow falls down around my windowsill. Here I sit all alone, gazing to the dying embers of a passion that once shook me like
that's the song How I Love You from bluegrass musician Becky Buller. We're on the phone today from Tennessee with Becky. You said it yourself, the economics of bluegrass are such that you have to do lots of things. So what all are you involved in just that song?
In that song, that particular song, well, I wrote it and actually wrote that one a long time ago back in college. And I'm playing fiddle on that one and singing. So, but actually in the greater bluegrass world, I do quite a bit. I'm a broadcaster. I have a radio show. It's called the Bluegrass Crossroads Show. It's on WMSR in Manchester, Tennessee. And I've been doing that program for about the last 8 years. My husband was doing it. And, I came on as a co-host with him and a couple other guys. So we switch off every other week and it's aired 3 times a week. And it's fun just being able to see that side of the industry because I feel like it makes me a little, it makes it easier for me to relate to the DJs and know what they need from the artists and how they need to get the CDs and or the music. And also I'm getting to, it's keeping me up to date on the fantastic music that my peers are creating. And I get to educate my community about the history of bluegrass music.
You studied classical violin, but primarily playing the fiddle. Now, don't make fun of me. What is the difference?
Attitude. It's just different styles. Bluegrass fiddle is a very improvisational style compared to like old time fiddle is all bluegrass and old time are both. You know, it's an oral tradition. Until very recently, it wasn't written down. It was just passed down, you know, from one fiddler to the next, sitting under a shade tree, sharing tunes. Now there's a lot of resources and sheet music and whatnot, lots of recordings, of course, to listen to. But still, it's basically an oral tradition. And so you get this wonderful ear training through playing bluegrass music and old-time music. But I did start out taking classical lessons from Patty Trias down in Mankato, Minnesota. And then I went on to take a couple years of lessons from Charles Gray at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. And I'm so grateful to have that well of knowledge to draw from because I do a lot of teaching. You were asking what else I do in the bluegrass industry. I do a lot of teaching here in Manchester, but then also online anywhere via FaceTime and Skype. And so I'm able to bring, you know, I can work with someone who wants to do classical music. I can work with somebody who wants to do bluegrass fiddle. But there's stuff that, you know, there's techniques from the classical side that definitely benefit a bluegrass picker. And then there's the ear training tradition in bluegrass that definitely benefits a classical player. So I really feel blessed that I got to learn both disciplines at the same time.
You mentioned your teaching, and I saw on your website that you teach, obviously in person if someone happens to be near you, but otherwise over Skype. Is it difficult to teach someone that you can't be in the same room with?
It's a little weird at first because, you know, you're looking at the computer and you're not sure where to look, because if you're not looking right at the camera, you know, you want to look at them to see their face and see how they're, if they're enjoying it or whatever, you know. But you have to look at the camera, and then it looks like you're really looking at them. And anyway, that can be kind of weird. And you also have to make sure that you're angling things right so the person can see your fingers as you're playing the tune. But other than that, I mean, just for like the first few minutes, it's a little weird, but then it's like you're in the same room with them.
This is one of my favorite questions to ask musicians, and I like when they kind of close their eyes and just tell me, what do you see when you pick up your instruments? Someone like me who doesn't know how to play it, I just see something that I don't know what to do with. What do you see?
Yeah, well, here lately I've been seeing my music room at home, because it's my place where I feel settled and safe, and even after all these years I still deal with a lot of stage fright. It's gotten a lot better, but that's my latest tactic to deal with that, is to just, I close my eyes and I see my music room and see my big cabinet with the record player in it and all the LPs and CDs, and you know, that's normally where I'm practicing stuff, and that's just where I feel so comfortable. And so, yeah, I know people that see colors, and I've never been quite like that, but yeah, I see home.
You have written songs that have been picked up by other musicians, and of course you've written songs that you perform yourself. Is it a different writing process for you?
I don't know if it's a different writing process so much as that some songs resonate with me more than other ones do. There's probably, I know there's a little bit of me in every song that I write. Sometimes you really have to dig to find it. Sometimes it's just like right there on the surface. But I do, I have all these songs on my latest album, Tween Earth and Sky, and all of them except one were written a long time ago, like 12 years ago, before my second to the last album came out. And they just didn't make the cut for that record, because you can only do so many. And then there's one song that I finished up the fall before we went into the studio. So it's been, I guess, a year and a half ago or so. But I'll do that. I do a lot of writing, and then some songs I'll say, I really want to cut that one myself. I'm going to squirrel that one away and keep it till I can get back in the studio. And then there's other ones that I'm like, I like this song, but I don't think I can sell it. I think this sounds like something so-and-so would sing, and so I'll pitch it to them.
Okay, so is it easy then to hear someone else sing your song? Because I feel like I would be like, no, this is my baby, and I would be very judgmental if someone didn't have the right inflection or what have you.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. And early on, some of the first cuts that I had as a songwriter, some of them I was like, oh, I wish they hadn't done that to it. And then other ones I was like, oh, that's awesome. I'm going to sing it the way they sang it, because he sang it so good. I'm going to sing it like he sang it. And you just have to kind of learn how to let go, you know, because once you put them out there and you know, that singer has to make them his or her own so that they can sell it. And you kind of have to be okay with that as a writer. And so, I've learned, I've had a few incidents that I really can't go into, but where I was, that were definitely learning experiences for me, and learning how to let go and be okay with it and just say, hey, I got a cut. This is great. I don't care that they totally changed the melody on that. They didn't change the writer name on that. It's still me. So hopefully I'm going to see some money from BMI about that, you know, or some airplay money or whatever. And yeah, it's just the nature of the beast.
Do you ever sing songs from other songwriters?
I do. And that's been one of the most fun things about starting my own band here at the first of the year. And I keep, it, as silly as it sounds, I keep as I'm sitting down to write these set lists, I keep thinking, hey, I have time. I have this whole set. I can do whatever I want to. I'm hiring the pickers, and I'm telling them what we're going to do. I can throw in a Simon and Garfunkel song if I want to, in addition to my own tunes. You know, most of what we do is my original stuff. So look for some surprises at the show at Crooked Lane.
And again, that show is on August 30th from 3 to 5 p.m. Tickets are $20 to $25. You're also going to be playing at a few venues in Minnesota, including the Great Minnesota Get-Together, the Minnesota mm-hmm. State Fair. That's a pretty big deal for a Minnesota native.
Yeah, it really is. I was trying to remember back this past week. I played in one of the talent competitions at the fair a long time ago, when I was in high school, I guess. And I did the Orange Blossom Special, and I remember being there, but I couldn't remember what happened. And I was actually doing an interview with a station down in Mankato, Minnesota, and I said just what I just said to you, and I said, now I know that my mom is yelling at the radio right now telling me exactly what happened. And sure enough, as soon as I got off the phone, I got a call, well, actually from my dad, saying, okay, here's what happened. You played the Orange Blossom Special, and they didn't turn the microphone on for the first couple notes, and so it totally bombed.
Oh.
but I'm excited because on this trip back, my band is playing at 8 o'clock both Monday, August 31st, and Tuesday, September 1st. It's 8 p.m. the West End Market stage, and we'll be doing a couple 90-minute shows. Each night, one 90-minute set each night. But during the day, I will be doing two shows each day with the National Guard Band for the state of Minnesota, the 34th Infantry Red Bulls Division. And I will get to do the Orange Blossom Special with them. So hopefully I can redeem myself.
I'm thinking you will.
Yeah, I'm so excited to get to guest with them.
Had your own band now since the beginning of the year, lots of time mm-hmm. playing with other musicians before that. What really made you sit down and say, okay, I can front a band, or what made you want to do that?
Well, it was sort of, I sort of painted myself into a corner. I had been happy being a side person because there's less responsibility when you're a side person. And I knew what it took to get a band on the road and moving and everything. And I didn't feel like I could do that. And then came this latest album, Between Earth and Sky, and which I recorded my daughter was about one when we started recording this, and we just finished up in the studio, and she started walking, and everything got crazy. At the time, I was playing for Darren and Brooke Aldridge out of Cherryville, North Carolina. Fantastic singers. It was so much fun being part of that trio, but I had to drive to North Carolina to meet the band to head to the shows, and they came this way sometimes, but it was just getting to be where I was burning the candle at both ends. I was absolutely exhausted. And then Romy started walking, and my husband and I looked at each other. We're like, you can't do this anymore. But I had a new record that I needed to sell, and I needed to tour in support of. And so I had to create my own schedule. I had to start my own band. I couldn't avoid it any longer.
Well, multi-instrumentalist, singer, songwriter, performer, Becky Buller, mother, host of a radio show, also gives lessons online. I would ask you what you do in your spare time, but it sounds pretty obvious to me that you don't have any spare time.
I need to do my dishes, but I did get some laundry in today, so that's good. That's promising.
Becky joins us from Tennessee. She's on the phone. Becky, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ashley, for having me.
We're going to hear from Chuck Lura with a Natural North Dakota essay, and we're going to wrap up this interview with another song from Becky Buller. Here's Topaz Moon.
A topaz moon set against an opaque sky is looking down upon the misty mountainside as I'm driving home in a haze of my own, just thinking about you again and wondering what went wrong.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And I was too much to bear, but it takes two hearts before a flame of passion starts. So it goes to figure that we're both to blame.
For fall color, you usually look up in the trees, but Mother Nature puts on a pretty spectacular show on ground level too. Here's naturalist Chuck Lura with some of his favorite flowers.
There are several members of the Aster family putting on a show of yellow in the road ditches right now, and you know what that means. Harvest season is upon us, school is about to start, and of course autumn is waiting in the wings. Yes, it's that time of year. Perhaps the most conspicuous yellow-flowered plant I'm seeing in the road ditches this time of year is field sow thistle, which looks like a 2 to 3 foot tall cousin of dandelions. It's an introduced weed that's native to Eurasia, and was first reported in the United States back in the early 1800s. It can now be found throughout much of North America, where it occupies a wide variety of habitats, ranging from wet meadows to cultivated and abandoned fields. Sow thistle does not have any real importance to livestock or wildlife, but if you're so inclined, a chicory-like drink can be made from the roasted roots. Many goldenrods are also in full bloom now. There are about 10 species native to North Dakota, but most of what I've been observing in the road ditches is Canada goldenrod and stiff goldenrod. These two species can easily be distinguished by the shape of their flower clusters. Rigid goldenrod has flat top flower clusters, while the flower clusters of Canada goldenrod are pyramidal in shape. And again, neither species is considered to be important forage for livestock or wildlife, but they certainly are an important food item for bees and other pollinators during this time of the year. No doubt many of you have noticed the wild sunflowers blooming in the road ditches. A half a dozen or so species of sunflowers can be found in the state, and the kinds of sunflowers in road ditches can be quite variable, but a lot of it is common or annual sunflower, which is a native version of the commercial sunflower. As many of you know, it's one of the few crops that we've developed from one of our native species. Finally, there's a plant producing a lot of small yellow flowers along the shoulders of many roads across the state. I'm thinking of curly cup gumweed. It, too, is a member of the Aster family, and as the name suggests, can be identified by the resinous material on the cup of the flowers. As you might expect, this plant's a species of disturbed areas and has little livestock or wildlife value. It's a native species, and the resinous material was not lost to Native Americans. The plant was used to treat a variety of ailments, ranging from saddle sores to rashes and poison ivy. So look for these flowers as you go about your travels. Our yellow flowering members of the Aster family are putting on their annual late summer, early autumn show, so enjoy it while you can. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Botno. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Chuck is a biology professor at Dakota College at Botno. Still to come on Main Street, on-demand body parts. No longer the realm of science fiction, but first, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A North Dakota-based tech company is breaking new ground when it comes to technology and the use and operation of unmanned aerial vehicles. Speaking at the State of Technology Conference in Fargo, Sean Mueller is COO of Botlink. He says the operating technology is called XRD, or Extended Range and Data.
What we've done is we've paired cellular technology with onboard processing in order to be able to fly a drone beyond line of sight, really anywhere in the entire world, from anywhere in the entire world, as long as you have cell coverage. Then whatever data you're collecting on board the aircraft, video images or what have you, you can process that data on board and in the cloud in real time.
Botlink is a joint company formed by hardware developer Packard Digital and software developer Aerobotic Innovations. Company CEO Terry Zimmerman says the pairing has been a strong matchup, with the XRD technology getting ready for a full launch.
We have customers lined up and working closely with them in the specifications of the product, so we're excited to be launching this within a couple weeks. We're planning to launch the product at Interdrone in Las Vegas September 9th through the 11th. So we're going to be on the worldwide marketplace with our product.
Zimmerman says the control and safety technology will enable operators of UAVs to fly smarter and safer. 48 different law enforcement agencies participated in the statewide Click It or Ticket seatbelt enforcement campaign during the month of July. Sergeant Tom Iverson is with the North Dakota Highway Patrol. He says in that time, law enforcement agencies issued about 2,800 citations total. He says about 970 of them were for seatbelt violations and 35 were for improper child restraint. Iverson says he's pleased with the overall results because it shows how hard law enforcement works to enforce seatbelt use. But Iverson says it is unfortunate that more people weren't wearing seatbelts. He says despite this, visible enforcement does work.
Having a strong, proactive enforcement effort, it really does prove to be beneficial. If people know that we're out there, they know that they're going to get a ticket. If you don't have your seatbelt on, you know, you will be getting a ticket. So the thought the fear of being caught sometimes will get people to correct their behavior. So it's important to maintain a strong enforcement effort.
Iverson says along with that, educating the public is also beneficial. And full-page ads will appear in North Dakota's Sunday newspapers this weekend to encourage young people to consider teaching as a career. The marketing idea came out of a task force on the teacher shortage in North Dakota. State School Boards Association Executive Director John Martinson says his organization took on that challenge.
Teaching is a great profession, and it's a rewarding career. And when you talk to teachers, they like what they do. So we're trying to promote that in order to get younger people, they could be in high school, they could be in the early years of college, to think about teaching as a profession, and there are jobs available.
Martinson says he'd also like to dispel the myths of low pay for teachers. He says while no one in education is getting rich, the average pay for North Dakota teachers is just under $49,000, and in some areas, the average is higher. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Game changer. It can be a person, a thing, or an idea, but it always leads to this. Revolution. The invention of paper. Flight. The A-bomb. The Beatles. It is not a word to be used lightly, but it is the word one professor is using about a group of his students and their work developing prosthetics. NDSU professor Dr. David Wells advises four of his students who are enthusiasts of 3D printing. They're turning their talents to the art and science of making artificial body parts. I met Dr. Wells and student Andrew Dolman. Dolman and three classmates recently won a genius grant for their work developing prosthetics. Their prototype is benefiting a young boy in Washington. Paige Browning from KPBX in Spokane and I worked together on the story of print-on-demand limbs.
See, the mirror comes off.
Oh, yeah. That's cool.
3-year-old Jameson Davis has all the things kids need. Loving parents, food, and a home. He has a mom who happily blogs about making rainbow cake and going to soccer practice. Jameson has his favorite toys.
My Jeep.
A little brother, Jack. And
I have a sister.
But Jameson does have a few wants, the kind that never occur to most of us.
Have fingers.
He's a bilateral transradial congenital amputee. Got that? No? Well, here's what it means. Jameson doesn't have anything below the elbow, on either arm. He was born that way.
And doctors couldn't tell us why this was happening to our baby, and they still don't know why. Even after he's born, they were concerned that it was possibly a syndrome or some kind of terrible genetic thing, but it's not. It was just a complete fluke. And
Mom Brooke Davis freely admits in her blog that she cried a lot after getting the news in the 20th week of the pregnancy. But she still calls his birth the happiest day of her life. And he was especially welcome after two miscarriages.
And the fire trucks.
Brooke and her husband Jim had to overcome a steep learning curve, but they didn't have to go it alone. Help poured in from friends and strangers across the country. There was even a cross-country bike trip raising money for little Jameson, who, of course, is not going to stay little for long, meaning he's going to need lots of sets of prosthetics.
He actually started at 18 months with prosthetics. We found that that has helped him adapt and learn.
Prosthetics are not one-size-fits-all. They need to be customized to fit a patient. There's been a lot of trial and error over the millennia. Yes, millennia. The oldest known prosthetic is an artificial toe made of wood and leather found on an Egyptian mummy. Bronze and iron came into play as early as 300 BCE. Today, artificial limbs have a skin-like feel. They're loaded with robotics, computer chips, and microprocessors.
They help me grab stuff.
So these have a sensor on his bicep that opens and closes the hand. So that's kind of what myoelectric means. You use your muscles to control the electronic pulses, and it opens up the hand and closes it.
Jameson's lower arms come from the U.S. company Advanced Arm Dynamics.
It's hard to open.
He has a special name for them.
Those are my open helpers. They're way working.
The website for Advanced Arm Dynamics shows artificial hands and fingers doing highly detailed work, like using zippers and a touchscreen phone. There's a picture of a bride where you have to look twice to even notice she has an artificial arm. That kind of R&D comes at a cost.
$25,000.
A recurring expense as Jameson grows.
We don't turn any opportunities down to get him all the help he needs.
Brooke Davis was only too happy to hear from her uncle, Dr. David Wells, with a cost-saving alternative.
Amazing opportunity.
Dr. Wells teaches manufacturing engineering at NDSU. This opportunity for the Davis family comes in the form of four of his students, one of whom is Andy Dahlman. You know the type. He's curious.
I always wanted to be an inventor.
And always reading.
I grew up with a copy of Grey's Anatomy, the large medical reference book, in my small personal library.
He has fun hobbies like
improving and healing and modifying the human body in positive ways.
His family had big plans for him.
My grandma wanted me to be the first American pope, which that hasn't worked out quite yet, at least. But I like to think I'm still doing good.
He and three classmates, Cooper Bierscheid, Tyler Skeet, and Mike Walmsley, worked together on a senior capstone project.
To 3D print a prosthetic arm.
It's when you take a digital file, send it to a specialized printer that prints layers of thin material to build a three-dimensional object. In the case of Jameson's forearm, the students are using a material called ABS.
Think about the dashboard in your car. That's generally an ABS material, and that's pretty rigid, pretty hard, pretty durable. So this is going to be somewhere in that same, not unbreakable, but pretty tough, pretty good stuff.
I feel like I shouldn't be throwing around body parts. But on the other hand, I mean, I feel like I could play wiffle ball with this, yep. You know, like yep. As the bat, yep. Not just hitting yep. It yep. With yep. My arm. Durability is not enough. Take a second to think about all the things your hands do.
Write, dress, take care of bodily needs, eat, play.
How much time have you spent just looking at your own arms?
In this project is probably greater than the sum total that I've spent in the rest of my life. I actually
had the team of engineering students needed to hit the ground running.
First thought, there's no way they can do this in one semester, but one of the things that I've learned that I never say to my students is no.
Even in this case, when they're making a body part and they don't have any kind of medical training.
One of the main things that you should keep in mind is that engineering as a discipline is primarily about problem solving until you create an answer. Whether the answer is a prosthetic arm or a new carburetor, The thinking process is pretty much the same.
One step in their process was knowing where to draw the line on what to replicate.
There is more than one way to skin a cat. So if we have a hole on this hand that we can attach a spoon to, that's far more straightforward than finicking all over the design and making sure that it can pick a spoon up perfectly. While you eventually may want to do that, in the interim, it's far simpler to have your mind open to not doing the things necessarily the exact same way nature did.
Are you essentially saying reinvent the arm?
Potentially.
The forearm they made for Jameson is about the size of a large banana, or maybe a plantain.
Forearm or a three-year-old. We didn't want to make it look like a 12-year-old.
There's a lot going on inside.
There are three motors, three actuators, battery, a circuit board, ligaments that come through the wrist end that attach and operate the fingers.
And the ligaments in this case are made out of?
Fishing line.
How do you product test an arm?
In our case, you send one to the patient and get their feedback. But there's a number of things we can do on our end. We can identify, say, a safety analysis, pinch points, any electronic hazards, an analysis of how much force various parts of the arm can take before a fracture.
You don't get to go around slapping people or flipping them off?
I won't tell you that didn't happen. There were some creative actuations of the fingers that occurred.
The NDSU version so far costs a lot less than prosthetics currently available.
I think right now the printing cost is about $400.
Compared to $25,000? What's going on? Well, for starters, the FDA approval process. It's usually years long and incredibly expensive. The license for the NDSU students is experimental, so it's a lot cheaper. And then, says Dr. Wells, there's embracing the new.
My generation is mired in adapting old techniques. This generation is quite comfortable with jumping away and using these brand new techniques as if it were natural. And to them, it is natural. And as a result, they get a far more cost-effective process of developing the product.
A cheaper and faster process combined with intelligence and passion, and it doesn't take long for Andy to start thinking about the next level of prosthetics.
Say the kid really liked Legos. There's nothing prohibiting us from designing a Lego pattern onto the arm such that he can build Legos on his arm or something like that. There's nothing prohibiting a creative child from going, hey, I want to do this. Okay, cool, let's do it.
Making the prosthetic device seem like an advantage instead of a disadvantage. I think the psychology of that could be really, really important. Give kids that have this affliction, turn it into a really positive advantage for them. Whether that will happen, I really can't say, but could it happen? Well, sure.
The team is hoping to find that out, with some prize money sure to be a boost. They won an OZY Genius Award for their work, which provides some financial backing and even a little business counseling.
They're putting a lot of trust in these people that they and the community have selected to do what they said they would do.
Andy says his ultimate goal is to design a print-at-home unit so it's easier and cheaper for people like the Davis family.
Being able to eventually help people with my work is enough to kind of satisfy me. So
you don't do this work in a vacuum. Something eventually will always be about people. The whole purpose of doing engineering is to do something positive for the world. That's what we do.
I hope they are strong enough to lift up a big car.
To lift up a big car?
Yeah.
Well, that'd be cool.
Jameson will use the arms, and the family will send feedback to the team to make any changes necessary. The team is called Protosthetics. They're working on a website. In the meantime, you can find them on Facebook and Twitter. The Davis family blogs about their lives at davisdaytoday.com, and that's the number two. And my thanks again to Paige Browning in Spokane for her reporting help. Up next, home videos on display.
Support is provided by Bremer Bank, offering money management tools and services designed to help companies save time and do more with their money. More about Bremer Business Banking at bremer.com. Bremer Bank, work hard, bank easy.
We're back on Main Street. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we've all seen home movies, and more than likely we've been in a few ourselves. They're a great way to capture our memories and share them with our families. And important as that is, there's a group of conservationists who think that our home videos can mean more and to more people. Here to explain is Deputy State Archivist Shane Molander with the State Historical Society. Shane, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
There are going to be three screenings of home movies across the state next week in Bismarck, Valley City, and West Fargo. So what do you mean when you say home movie screenings? Are we talking Easter egg hunts?
Actually, for the events, we at the Historical Society have a collection of film and video, and some of it also includes home video that's video or film that's come in from the general public that asked us, hey, are you interested in this? And if it's has some historical significance, yeah, we're certainly interested. Your Easter egg hunts and, you know, the first step and all that, that's not so much historical, not what the Historical Society is looking for. But there's a lot of good stuff, for example, agricultural scenes. In the Inspiration Gallery in the new expansion to the Heritage Center, we put together different agricultural scenes that brought us from the early part of the 19th century up to the present, just to see how the equipment changed and how things were done. And that a lot of that came from home video because people would be out there and, oh, there's Dad out on the combine. Let's shoot some film of that. And we were able to put together pieces that kind of chronologically brought us up to the present date on equipment. So it's that type of stuff that we're interested in, the types of home video. There's also town scenes, parades, events, cultural events. There's a lot of things captured in home video that aren't just of, you know, the individuals in the families, which is important too, especially from a genealogical standpoint. But we try to get more of the historical type scenes.
Sure. Is this footage, I mean, it almost sounds a little like it's footage you wouldn't have if it wasn't for home videos. There's not necessarily going to be professionally shot video of every hometown parade. Is that fair to say?
Oh, that's absolutely correct. Yeah. And that's the same with any types of collections, not just video, but everything. We can't really get a good, accurate historic picture without going to the general public, the population, and seeing what they have, what they've collected through their lifetimes to get a good idea and a good historical perspective of how we lived life in the past.
These screenings are going to be in Bismarck on September 2nd from 6:30 to 8 at the Heritage Center, in Valley City on September 3rd from 7 to 8:30 at the Barnes County Historical Society Museum, and in West Fargo on September 4th from 6:30 to 8 at Bonanzaville, the Cass County Historical Society there. Just paint us a mental picture. What are the screenings going to be like?
Well, first I'm going to show some video from our collections at the State Archives. And that's going to be some raw footage. I'll have some clips. There could be, like I mentioned, some agricultural scenes, the parades. Wes Anderson from the Barnes County Historical Society sent me up some film that we digitized, and one of them is a parade in Valley City with Peggy Lee there.
Wow.
And there's a glimpse of her riding in a car down Main Street there. And we'll probably include some of that. And then after I'll do some of ours, and then we're going to do some of the Al Larvik film. Kirsten Larvik, who started this fund that we're going to be talking about at the event, her grandfather was a film enthusiast. He was a teacher and athletic director, amongst other things, in Valley City in the 50s. And he shot a lot of film, and she took some of that film and made, edited it down and did voiceover talking about who's in the film and whatnot. And it's really great. I got to view one of them yesterday. And so we'll be showing those. And then following the screening of these home videos, we're going to have a workshop. And that's going to, we have an expert coming in from California, Rhonda Vingent. And she is with Pro 8mm. They're a business. They do digitizing, preservation, and she's going to discuss how to care for your home video, whatever format it may be in, and I'll have a lot of questions for her, and I hope people come out and see her, and we can learn a lot from her.
Speaking of format changes for home videos, I mean, I have seen pictures of my grandpa carrying just a ginormous machine on his shoulder and taking these home videos. And then, of course, I can just whip out a cell phone that weighs a couple ounces and take videos. Talk about the changing role of how we are shooting home videos.
Well, that is something that has changed all the time, and it will continue to change as that's how, you know, things get sold. We have to change things. It keeps businesses going. But, I mean, a lot of the home video, I know the first Larvik film is 8mm film, and there's 16mm film. You get into, in the more modern 80s era, you get into 3/4-inch tape and VHS tape, and then you get those tiny mini tapes, which come in several different sizes. I know I have a couple of different ones at my house, and they're impossible to find tapes to use anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're into, you know, the iPad and the iPhone, and, you know, which is incredible. And, you know, preserving those is going to be a challenge. You know, you might shoot a bunch on your phone, and then, okay, I'm out of space. What do I do with it? Do I delete so I can do my other things that I do with my phone, or put it in the iCloud, or what have you? And I hope these are some things that Rhonda will address at those events as well.
Is there going to be any talk about just the different kind of equipment? I mean, I can plug in my iPhone to my Mac and take the video off, whether it's Facebook or I send it just via email. But these older formats, these machines are getting harder to find and much, much harder to fix. Is there any focus on preserving the actual equipment?
Well, that's a good question. We at in the state archives, we have a lot of the equipment to do a lot of formats, and it's expensive and it's rare. For example, we have a lot of tape, not necessarily home movies, but news tape that has come in from television stations that is on 3/4-inch tape. And that is a very volatile format. And the machines to play those are rare. They haven't been made probably since the early 80s. I've purchased them online. They're used. You don't know how long it's going to last. And we need those to transfer that video to get it into a digital format so we can, you know, preserve it.
You mentioned the Al Larvik Conservation Fund. What does that do?
What it does is there's a North Dakota fund, and you apply for a grant and to have your home movies digitized. And since he's from North Dakota, he ended up moving out west later in life, but he's from North Dakota, and that's why his granddaughter is setting this up just for North Dakota residents. There's going to be a national one later on. But this first one is for North Dakotans. You apply. It's like a $2,000 grant, and then there'll be some matching in-kind work that will be done on it. And, you know, if you have a huge collection, it might not do it all, but it's a start. And getting people to be aware of the home movies they have and how they need to preserve them is important and kind of what this thing is about. And we hope we get some applicants and get some of their home movies preserved.
What does a deputy state archivist do?
Well, I'm in the state archives, which is a division of the Historical Society. And what we do is collect records, state government records, local government records, and also records from the public, manuscript collections. Let's say your grandmother's diaries are really interesting and they talk about life out here. We may collect something like that. We collect books, anything to do with North Dakota and the Northern Great Plains. And also, like I say, video. Like from news stations, we collect from – there are state agencies that shoot a lot of film. The DOT, Water Commission, they shoot a lot of film. We take that in. And, yeah, just about anything that's going to help preserve the history of North Dakota.
Shane Molander is the Deputy State Archivist with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. There are going to be 3 screenings coming up for home movies in Bismarck on September 2nd, Valley City on the 3rd, and in West Fargo on the 4th. And you can find out more at allarvikfund.eventbrite.com. Shane, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Dakota Datebook is next.
And one time on this road trip, a white lady cut us off in her car. And my mother said, "Cracker." And my father said, "Doris." And so my mom said, "Saltine."
Join us for the Moth Radio Hour, true stories told live from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Tomorrow at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 26th. As the summer of 1941 passed by, the United States was still not at war. That would come on December 8th, after Pearl Harbor. But even though the country was still at peace, war was looming. Canada announced that women could join the armed forces, although there was no plan to send them overseas. In London, Lord Beaverbrook stated his hope that the United States would join the war. California Senator Hiram Johnson feared that that would be the case, saying President Roosevelt was determined to get the country involved in the shooting. There were also signs that shortages would soon be a reality. The Office of Production Management announced that bicycle manufacturers had agreed to cut production and reduce the weight by 10%, eliminating unnecessary metal decorations. Senator Nye of North Dakota demanded an investigation into reports of a gasoline shortage on the East Coast, believing it was nothing short of a charade to increase support for the war. Another sign of war-related change came in the form of a fashion show hosted by Eleanor Roosevelt that featured women's work clothes. Designer Clarice Scott announced that she intended to produce fashions that were economical while introducing comfort and fashion into the factory and the farm. The farmerette could be fashion conscious while driving a tractor, wearing a smart field suit made of cotton topped with a Chinese-style hat. There were also practical styles designed for the farmerette who had to work outside in rainy weather. For the factory girl, Scott reworked a mechanic's jumpsuit. The female version had a blouse with short sleeves and came with a matching cap. But perhaps the most alarming fashion news came on this date in 1941 in the form of a headline that read, "Don't scream, girls, but cotton hosiery is coming." The silk supply was dwindling, with only enough for about 2 months. When that was gone, it would be cotton, nylon, rayon, or nothing. Government experts promised a product that would be so like silk that women would never know the difference. One of the experts stated that he hoped women would be patient as the new product was perfected, explaining that we want to please the little cupcakes. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, grief is never an easy emotion, and a grief support team is aiming to connect widows with grief counselors. Also, Chef Rosie talks about eggplant, part fruit, part vegetable, and related to tobacco. Until then, have a great evening.